Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now are Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Prophets Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog, Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And Dean, the global stock markets fell after comments from some members of the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, suggesting that its stimulus measures may be increasing the risk of future economic and financial imbalances. Now, how does that gel with the overall argument between those who feel that what the economy needs now is stimulus as opposed to austerity?
Well, I think what you're seeing happening is that there had been something approaching a consensus on the Fed that for the stimulus camp. That wasn't always true. So if you go back in 2011, there were several people that quite strongly dissented from the measures that Bernanke was taking at the time, from QE2 at that time. It seemed
that he had won people over and there was
clear support at the Fed for strong measures. And the news that we got with the release of the minutes was that the summary minutes, that there were people on the Fed who questioned that commitment. And I think that's why you saw reaction from the markets, that the Fed may not be as aggressive in providing stimulus, continuing with QE3 or whatever we're calling it at this point, as had previously been believed.
And QE means quantitative easing. It's a euphemism for what? Buying bonds, $85 billion a month, right?
That's right. So this is departure from normal monetary policy. Ordinarily, the Fed simply targets the short-term, the overnight interest rate. And since this downturn, we've had what we've been calling quantitative easing, where it's involved purchases of large amounts of long-term bonds, both government bonds and also, to a lesser extent, mortgage-backed securities.
So is there any a danger here in terms of servicing the debt? And I don't want to give aid and comfort to the Pete Petersons, the sky is falling deficit hawks. And it's worth noting that the Simpson-Bowles people have suddenly come back again with another proposal for austerity. And as you know, the government is about to face a sequester shutdown, or a lot of money is going to be pulled out of the economy in the name of fiscal discipline. And of course, that brings again back to the argument about austerity versus stimulus. So is there anything to the idea that if you raise the interest rates, that's going to make the servicing of the debt even greater?
Well, a few things to keep in mind. First off, when we actually look at the burden, the interest burden of the debt, we're pretty much at a post-war low. It's about 1% of GDP. We were at 3% of GDP back in the early 90s. So we're way, way low. You know, so this idea, you know, we have this horrible burden. The people say that just are not looking at the data. The other point to be made about that, you'd raise the issue, okay, suppose interest rates rise. Well, to a large extent, that doesn't matter. Insofar as we're issuing 10-year bonds, 30-year bonds, that's locked in. So what happens when interest rates rise, if for something to be the case that, you know, interest rates were to go up a lot, well, then the people holding those bonds suddenly have bonds that are worth less. And in fact, what that means is the outstanding value of our debt is worth less. That's the way it would be accounted in the private sector. So in a certain sense, that's not even our problem. But, you know, the last part of that story, why would we think interest rates are about to rise? You know, the people have been saying that, have been jumping up and down, yelling and screaming, we're going to see interest rates go through the roof, the markets are going to lose confidence, bond market vigilantes. They've been saying that for 5 years now, and, you know, the rest of us, I think, are justified in getting a little tired of hearing it. You know, it's simply not true. If you could show anything to be false in this world, that's one of the things that's false.
So then why did the markets go down around the world at the same time the dollar went up?
Well, I think, as I say, I think the main reason the markets went down was the expectation there'd be less stimulus from the Fed, less boost to the economy. So in general, You know, half the time when the markets move, it's because of no reason whatsoever, and you're going to get a lot of nonsense from people telling you why the markets move. But insofar as we could find something that plausibly explains their movement, I think it's the expectation that we're going to get less growth because the Fed's not as committed to expansionary policy as people previously believed. That was the news in the new report.
But how can you separate that out from the really big news, the clear and present danger of the sequester suddenly taking enormous amount of money out of the economy if the Republicans go ahead and shoot the economy in the foot?
Well, that will hurt the economy, but just to be clear, you're asking me about a market movement. If the market moves, you can't explain the market moving based on what's been known for a long time. Mm-hmm. So the news was that the Fed released minutes suggesting that they were less committed to their stimulus policy than had previously been believed. The sequester we've known about since January 2nd.
Yeah, but we don't know whether it's going to be resolved, though, do we?
No, but we didn't get any new information on that. That's what I'm saying. So you can't explain the market suddenly having a fairly big movement based on no new information. That doesn't make sense.
I see. So let's talk then about that, Dean Baker, because it seems to me that these successive manufactured crises are going to surely paying a toll on the American economy. And it's odd to be in a situation where you're defending military spending, but the evidence from the last quarter of last year was that just taking a little bit of military spending out of the economy caused the growth rate to dip precipitously, and taking a lot more out with the sequester and making these cuts across the board, which everybody, of course, is crying over at the moment, is going to even do more damage. So,
Well, let's just be clear. That's been really misrepresented. Any cut to spending anywhere will slow economic growth. And, you know, there's nothing magical about the military. This is, you know, that this is being repeated in the media, and it really is kind of amazing because basically anyone who acts that way, they just writes that. I can't imagine what they are thinking. The economy doesn't distinguish between dollars that are spent on the military and dollars that are spent on food stamps or any number of other things. A dollar is a dollar. The economy doesn't care that it's blessed as military spending. So that part doesn't make any sense. The decline in GDP in the fourth quarter, by the way, associated with military spending, was actually associated with what was reported as a very, very sharp decline in military spending. Military spending declined at over 22% annual rate in the fourth quarter. Now, it did not actually decline at 22% annual rate. There's always erratic movements in military spending, so it was reported as increasing at a 13% annual rate in the third quarter. So most of this was just a reversal of an increase reported in the third quarter. It didn't actually increase at a 13% rate in the third quarter. The reason why that happened was probably they recorded some jet deliveries in the third quarter that, you know, they were coming in over, you know, at the end of September, and they happened to all be recorded as appearing in September. So anyhow, long and short is I'm just saying we didn't get a big surge in military spending in the third quarter. We didn't get a big plunge in the fourth quarter. This was just an accounting issue. But, you know, we're looking at the sequesters around a 7 or 8% cut in military spending. That certainly has an impact on the economy. You know, as I was saying a moment ago, a dollar, doesn't matter whether you like what it's being spent on or not. That's going to slow economic growth. And if we go through with the sequester, which is cuts on both the military and domestic side, it's probably going to knock somewhere around 0.2% off the growth rate. And given the economy's not growing all that rapidly anyhow, that's going to be a big hit.
Again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog, Beat the Press, and his latest ebook is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. So just in terms of the sequester and the likelihood that the economy is going to take a hit, and again, we keep having these manufactured crises, and this is the latest one. And already my understanding is, and everybody that gets a paycheck has surely noticed that they're getting less because of the last deal that was made in an extorted kind of crisis mode was the fiscal cliff deal, which ended the payroll tax holiday. So that's already affecting the economy, surely. I mean, that's real money that people have in their paychecks that is being taken out of the economy.
That's right. The end of the payroll tax cut meant that people are paying 2 percentage points more in Social Security taxes on wage income up to $113,000. So for most middle-income people, they're seeing 2% more of their wages disappear in taxes. And that's a big hit, and that's going to mean they're going to spend less, and that almost certainly is going to be a drag on growth. We don't have data yet that's going to reflect that, because for most people, it was just, you know, the first time they saw it was a check maybe in the middle of the month of January or at the end of the month when they got a monthly paycheck. But, you know, we probably will see that when we get more data for February. You know, that for the most part, that's not in yet, but we probably will see that. And that's likely to slow growth probably on the order of, you know, 5, 6, 7 tenths of a percentage point. And again, you know, if we had a robust recovery, if the economy is going along 4, 4.5 percentage points, you might say, okay, we could live with that. But given that we were looking at economy grew just 1.5% in the second half of 2012, we don't have a lot of momentum going into 2013, which means we're likely to see, you know, at best, very low rates of growth and probably not even a fast enough rate of growth to keep pace with the growth of the labor market, meaning we're likely to see some increase in the unemployment rate when we should want to see it fall.
But isn't this crazy, Dean Baker? I mean, it makes absolutely no sense to me that if we haven't really recovered from the 2008 crash, and it's been a long and painful process, and here we are, you know, limping along, and then because of political zealotry and gamesmanship and ignorance, I don't know how to describe the attitude of the House Republicans, but they're about to shoot us in the foot and add to the pain, and of course, the payroll tax cut in itself is a regressive tax. So, you know, who's the champion for the middle class out there and the working American?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I'll be bipartisan in my criticisms because President Obama hasn't stepped forward and said, look, you know, we have to stop worrying about these deficits and we have to focus on getting people back to work. I mean, reality is we don't have a deficit problem. We got big deficits because the economy collapsed. And it's easy to show. You could show it 100 different ways. We had relatively modest deficits in 2006, 2007 going into this downturn. We didn't just go on a crazy spending spree or a tax-cutting orgy. The reason the deficits exploded was because the economy collapsed, and the deficits are what's supporting the economy right now. So it would be nice if we had someone out there in a position of prominence, obviously President Obama would be best, making that argument and saying that this obsession with the deficit is nonsense. We have to focus on moving the economy. But, you know, he bought into this. You're literally raising Bull Simpson. He was the one who appointed them. He appointed these two deficit hawks to head this commission on fiscal responsibility. So he really surrendered, I think, 90% of the ground in terms of having a rational debate. I certainly don't like what the Republicans are doing, but unfortunately, as I say, I don't think President Obama and the Democratic leadership have particularly set out a much better agenda.
And he also, the president, hasn't really explained to the American people that the root cause of our economic troubles is Wall Street, and that we have what happened in 2008 and subsequent to it was the most massive transfer of wealth in history, where an enormous amount of private debt became public debt. In other words, we all got stuck with the bill.
Well, he hasn't explained the story well at all, and you know, you have a lot of people running around convinced that, you know, we got into this situation because the government was overspending, or, you know, we had poor people buying houses they couldn't afford. There is a little truth to that, but that's only very, very misleading. I mean, the key part of the story was that you had banks making loans that they had good reason to think couldn't be paid back. That's the real story here, and selling them, of course, in the secondary market. He really hasn't made the argument here. He's basically bought into this deficit hawk line that, as I say, there's basically no truth to, because it's easy to show. We didn't have a problem with the deficit before the economy collapsed. And, you know, he had a stimulus package back in 2009, 2010, which was a good thing, created 2 to 3 million jobs by most estimates, and I think those are certainly reasonable numbers. But the problem was we needed somewhere in the order of 10 to 12 million jobs. And his advisors, you know, people like Larry Summers and Christine Romer, both of them left the administration, knew that wasn't enough. They knew it wasn't enough. And they told President Obama that. But rather than him going out and saying, well, this is a good start, but we likely need more, he said, we're going to pivot to talk about deficit reduction. So he basically gave away most of the argument, and it's very difficult for him now to talk about the economy's real problems.
And just in closing, Dean Baker, do you have any idea why he did that? It's always been a mystery to me. One, why he let the Tea Party run away with the outrage over Wall Street and the TARP spending. And two, why that initial stimulus package was inadequate. I mean, everybody in the world, you were saying it, Paul Krugman was saying it, everybody was shouting from the rafters. And you just mentioned, even people within the White House were talking about it.
Well, in terms of, you know, why he hasn't, you know, pushed a different line, I think, you know, it's clear he's very close ties to Wall Street, you know, so he certainly got in with a lot of support from Wall Street people. Here I'm thinking people like Robert Rubin, and many of the people who hold top positions in the administration have close ties to Wall Street. So in that sense, I'm not terribly surprised that he's not anxious to confront Wall Street. On the other part of the question, I think what happened there was a couple things. One, I think they really didn't understand what was going on in the downturn. I think they really did think that the economy would bounce back more quickly. And if you look back at the projections that they and others were making at the time, they had the economy bouncing back by 2010, 2011. We should be at somewhere around 5.5% unemployment today if you look at those projections. And that's even if they didn't have the stimulus. So I think their view was, to a large extent, would have been better to have a bigger stimulus. You can't get it through Congress, and that assessment may well be right. I'm no expert on that. Certainly had to struggle to get what they got. So why not just take what you can get and then go out and celebrate it rather than saying, okay, that's not big enough. We might need more. And, you know, as you said, you know, I, Paul Krugman, many others were saying you should go the latter route. And, you know, I think events have indicated that was correct. But, you know, he's staying the course, even though that course looks like a really big loser, at least from the standpoint of the American people.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.